everyone. This is Corinne Lafon, your favorite radio host, your only radio host and favorite girl, of course, broadcasting to you from the lovely island of Trinidad and Tobago in the Caribbean on Between the Lines. And today I have with me a repeat guest. I don't know what's going on with these people. They keep coming back on my show. I have Dr. L.B. Wells here with me. Oh my gosh, she's such a darling. She's a sister. She's everything to me. I'm telling you, she's so sweet. I promised her off air. I mean, you can't see her, but she's absolutely beautiful. She's absolutely beautiful. She's white, so I promised to get her black. Okay, that is one of the things. One of the things for 2023. We're going to work on it.
Oh my goodness.
We're going to work on it. Let me tell you a bit about her. We're going to go straight into the discussion.
You knew that you're winning the Nobel Prize.
Oh, yeah. I wasn't even thinking that, but that's a thought. No, I'm challenged to do it. Okay. So L.B. Wells is the pseudonym that she's using for a very successful board-certified surgeon. An ambitious physician, you know, that could be a tongue twister, you know, an ambitious physician who made her way through the jungle of medical training while overcoming the resistance of the male-dominated world of surgery. Wells has written a novel that unleashes the ambition necessary for a woman to push through the long road to becoming an esteemed surgeon while discovering sexuality and forbidden love for the first time. Entitled The White Coat, that's the name of her book, Wells has created a multicultural story that is often overlooked in today's literary landscape. Her protagonist, Rory, a student from a devout Jewish background, is a late bloomer who loses her virginity in her 20s. Who remembers when they lost their virginity? Don't talk about it. Okay. Her early interactions with men are bumpy affairs that have her wondering what love and sex are all about. I think we are still wondering that, by the way. We will discuss that. With humor and compassion, Wells describes how her mother kept her under wraps, don't they all, and don't we all, and worried more about the upkeep of their elaborate suburban home than her coming-of-age frustrations. And then in med school, Rory falls passionately in love with Amir. He sounds lovely already. An Islamic surgeon from Pakistan. Both families turn against their children when confronted with a love affair that tears down religious boundaries. The resolution of their relationship is a dramatic study of whether love can conquer all obstacles. Welcome, Dr. L.B. Wells, to Between the Lines.
Thank you, Corinne. It's nice to be welcome here, as always.
Yes.
Thank you for allowing me to be a repeat offender.
Right? A repeat offender. I love that. I love that. Listen, love conquer it all. We ended with that in your bio. That's a great way to start. Love conquers all. Do you believe that?
I'd like to believe it. I personally, in my own autobiographical life, that hasn't quite happened yet, but I do believe it. I believe it sort of deep in my heart.
Yeah. I think, you know, they tell it in the movies, they tell it in the books, they tell it in the stories. I believe that love conquers all. It's just that thing.
Mm-hmm. I've seen it. I've seen people that, you know, that's their epicenter. So yeah. I have to believe it.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. And I think once united, especially from what you're talking about, the white coat effect, and now I'm connecting it to, you know, as I talk about it, because the white coat goes with being a surgeon, obviously. I love it. Mm-hmm. So it works together, two surgeons, yes, in the medical field. And so I believe that once two people, no matter what is like, once two people are in love, I mean, truly, genuinely in love, and they know what they want and they want each other, it's them against the world. And I think that's what love conquers all really means. It's like us against the world.
I think that you make a really good point. I mean, look, part of that, you know, part of that, you get a little bit caught up in the drama. The world's not against you, but you found your partner who relates to you in such a way that no one else does. And in that sense, it does become you against the world, you and your partner against the world, because it's two people who, you know, are like-minded and they've shared themselves in such a way that quite possibly no one else in the world can can understand. By the way, I want to put a little note out there. I'm so glad that you interpreted the white coat effect the way that you did, that it would be between two surgeons. I want to just mention what the white coat effect really is.
Go ahead. I would love to hear it.
Oh yeah. It's a medical phenomenon, actually.
Is it?
Yes, it is. It's when a person goes to see the doctor, mm-hmm. and they are having, or he or she is having his blood pressure taken. Uh-huh. It doesn't happen to everybody. It happens in some of the population. Mm-hmm. His or her blood pressure will falsely elevate because of the nerves involved with seeing the doctor. So
I have had that. Every time yes. I go in the hospital, my blood pressure raises.
It happens. So you have the white coat effect. That's called the white coat effect.
And that is why the nurses say, don't take your pressure in hospital. Everybody blood pressure goes.
Wait, if you go to the local drugstore, you have a blood pressure machine at home, you'll find that your blood pressure might be very, very normal and mm-hmm. might be quite abnormal when you go to the physician.
Why is it that we don't like you guys? We don't like you guys.
I know. I'm sorry. But I named it that for that reason. I wanted that double entendre. I wanted people to kind of, you know, try to make some guesses as to what the white coat effect really is. Mm. Is it that excitement you get when you see a doctor? Is it that, you know, sort of sexuality that a lot of doctors walk around with, you know, yes. when around with that bravado.
Yes, they do.
I wanted all of those feelings to be evoked when I titled the book.
Yes. But now that you explain the medical phenomenon, now you have my mind going in a different direction. That when you do see, yeah, that when you go a particular place, let's not specifically say, you know, in a hospital, but you're in an environment or you're surrounded by someone, yes, that spikes your yes. blood pressure.
Well, yes. And I, like I said, the title's supposed to reflect the number of ways and why that person might spike your blood pressure.
mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I could tell you who spikes my blood pressure. Yeah. There is that guy.
In this story, Amir certainly spikes Rory's. So
listen to me, we're going to come to Amir, but I'm going to tell you, and everybody's going to know now. And when this goes public, should the guy hear it, I want him to know that he spikes my blood pressure. Omari Hardwick. He acted on
Omari, yes, Omari
Hardwick.
Omari you Hardwick. Look. Hear that.
Yes, hear okay, that. Even though you're married, sweetie.
White coat effect on Corrine. That is
even
like
though you're
very
married. Even though you're married, I don't care. And he has that effect on all women. Let me tell you.
Yeah,
all
Omari,
women.
You probably know it. But my Corrine girl here is special. So don't be playing around with her. That's all I have to say.
My blood pressure.
Or you're
going
to have a really angry white girl to contend with.
Please tell them, LB. Please. So I'm just letting
you don't
want to
mess with LB Wells. I know my way around a knife.
We're not threatening you here now, but threatening you to move to.
Please, I'm exerting my First Amendment rights in any way, shape, or form.
But listen, she's on my side. That's my sister there. She's on my side. But coming back to Amir, and coming back to before Amir, let's get into the context we normally get in, LB. We are under our parents, and we know that parents, you know, they're supposed to protect and guide. And some of us, and I say us because I'm a parent, but I am not like that. Some of the parents tend to be a bit more controlling. And like you said in your bio, you know, to maintain a status quo. And so it prevents you. And it seems as if parents forget what love really is like, what it means, what it feels like. Or is it that they are afraid, or they didn't have that type of love that they're seeing that your characters had or you had, and they're scared where it goes because that is what they probably had experienced in their own life and didn't get it and would certainly love to have it, but they're scared. You know, love can be a very scary thing.
Absolutely.
Just like when your heart, when your blood pressure goes up, it's scary.
You're making so many valid points all in one statement. You know, I, again, autobiographically, I have and had loving parents who were very controlling. You know, the sort of modern day hella parents, helicopter parents, you know, that or the snowplow parent or whatever. I mean, you know, my parents never did what like those celebrities did, you know, with getting me into college and all that stuff, but they were hovering. And, you know, I would say, just to give an autobiographical note, which does appear in the book, my four grandparents were survivors of the Holocaust.
Wow.
Okay. So I am Jewish, as is the character. Mm-hmm. So I think when in the family, you know, one generation back like that, when you experience that, you can become very overprotective of your children, obviously.
Yeah.
And with good reason, but unfortunately, some of that has a negative effect on the child in that the child becomes very fear-based and, you know, realizes or recognizes they have to make up for these lost lives. You know, there's a lot of pressure on that child. So I would say that, you know, in my family, while there was unconditional love, there was also conditional love.
Wow.
Okay. And, you know, I will say that I embellish a little bit in the book, but not too much. My own mother, grew up very, very beautiful. She was a cheerleader and she was not really a student. She didn't like school very much.
Wow.
She was popular. She was
cheerleaders are
boy. She was popular with the girls. She was a popular girl. And like I said, a cheerleader, which, you know, my school didn't have cheerleading. We had the tennis squad and I actually was a serious tennis player. So I was the captain of my tennis squad. And a lot of the girls liked to walk around in the skirts and pretend they were on the cheerleading team. And I said, if I'm wearing my skirt, I mean business. Like I'm gonna kill somebody on the tennis game on the tennis court. But you know, but that's because, like I said, I was a serious player. Mm-hmm. But so in the story, the mother's called Simone Weber. Mm-hmm. That's their last name, and Simone repeatedly tells her daughter, you know, especially as she's going through her awkward years when she's young, and she is. Mm-hmm. I have a whole chapter called The Egg with Legs because that's the shape of Rory's body. She is an egg on top, and not in a good way. Like the small part of the egg is her top. and she's got these skinny, gawky legs. So so Simone consistently reminds her in this exact quote, unfortunately, darling, you did not inherit my looks, but you did inherit your father's brains. So your one chance in life is going to be to succeed career wise.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the message that young Rory picks up. And so she lives inside this very painful world. You know, on the outset, you would think she has everything. You know, her father is a physician and he's not uber wealthy, but he is certainly like upper middle class. And they have a very large house and they have everything that they could possibly need or have or want. But Simone, Rory's mother, kind of treats the house like a museum. You know, if Rory's going to lean on the counter, don't touch the counter. Don't touch.
Wow. That's controlling.
That kind of thing. You know, I have to clean that up later. You know, this kitchen's for show and the other kitchen is the one that you're allowed to use, you know? So, there was a lot of that
glass, like a glass house type of thing.
A bit. And so, you know, all of Rory's, you know, imaginations about what that house would mean, that she would be popular and people would come over. There was a swimming pool and there was even a tennis court, that everybody would come over and she would be popular. but it didn't happen because no one was ever allowed inside the doors of the house. Wow. So, so she struggles with that inner pain. Look, there might not be anybody who sort of, I would say, relates or sympathizes with the overprivileged child, but when a child is sort of locked away in a very solitary world like that, he or she does experience pain. And
I can tell you, let me interrupt you here. I could tell you people can relate to that, whether they are wealthy or not wealthy, because there are some communities that are overprotective, whether or not. I don't think it has anything to do with wealth. It is just the upbringing and the belief and the protection, the control.
Absolutely.
You know?
And our society has made it much more about, wealth versus non-wealth. But
it's not.
People, of all shapes and sizes and socioeconomic backgrounds have their demons and their pain.
Of course.
No denying that. It comes from somewhere. So that's kind of how she grows up. And she's she's told sex is off the table. It's not allowed. No questions asked. Mom tells Rory what sex is and says,
and that's it.
And don't even think about having it. Don't even think about it.
Passing on your fear as a parent to your child is nuts.
And there's a very funny chapter where she goes away to tennis camp. And she's finally starting to come out of her awkward phase. She's also, exercising a ton because she's at tennis camp. And so she's playing tennis 8 hours a day. And she attracts the eye of the older counselor, who's very, very attractive. And one night, the boys and the girls are not allowed to go to each other's, they're in different towers.
Typically, but we know what happens. We know what happens, LB.
But of course, Rory sneaks across with Bradley, and
who doesn't, of course.
And she stays with him, and he kisses her, and that's her first kiss, and she is disgusted. Okay,
you know. Let me tell you, I'm going to tell you, my first kiss was very disgusting. I found it was the nastiest thing ever.
I said, who does this and why?
Why? I'm like, this is the nastiest thing ever. I am never doing that again.
Right. We do it again and it becomes a very different experience. But
right? But that first kiss, Jesus.
I'm sure he was a good kisser. I'm sure there's nothing. Nothing wrong with him. It was just the idea of a
this transference and sharing of spit. Let's call it what it is.
Sharing a spit and a slimy tongue coming unfurling into your mouth
and your tongue going all over. I'm like,
be thought about that? Nothing. The book, Rory says to him, can we just slow down and can we just lie here for a while? Okay. So Bradley cops a feel or two and it's like 2 o'clock in the morning. So Rory falls asleep.
She wakes up maybe
18 minutes later.
Don't go any further, LB. I don't want you to give everybody the book.
I'm giving you one little chapter, just to show you some of the humor in the book. So Rory wakes up 18 minutes later and she's fumbling around, making sure all of her clothes are on. And she says, she tells Bradley, I've got to go. And she runs. And in that camp, you're not allowed to have cell phones. So there was a payphone. She calls Mom Collect and says, Mom, I think I just had sex, which is the name of the chapter. And Simone says, well, wait a minute. You think you just had sex? She's groggy. She's angry. It's 3 o'clock in the morning, whatever time it is. And she says, are all your clothes intact? She says, yes. Was there penetration? And Rory says, penetration? And so Rory's mom says, you did not have sex. And we'll see you at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. And Rory says, well, wait a minute, Mom. What do you mean I'll see you at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning? She says, you don't think that you're going to have sex fake or otherwise, and that your mother and I are going to let you stay at camp, do you?
For her to actually have sex. No, right. No.
Real but, or otherwise, kind of. Fake or otherwise. So anyway, so she fumbles through some relationships until she finally kind of gives up on the idea of a relationship. And like she goes all the way through, like most of us have to before we find a relationship, and fumbles through the first couple of years of medical school when suddenly she meets, you know, her sort of Clark Kent Superman, 350 joules of energy coming from his green eyes, attacking Rory. Actually, when they first pass by each other, she accidentally touches him, and there's a old rug, shaggy rug on the floor. So there's a shock, like a spark.
The white coat effect. There's the blood pressure. The blood pressure.
I mean like one of those when you pass by somebody and you get a little electric shock, not in a pleasant way.
Omari Hardwick, and he hasn't even passed by me.
So we'll try that. So she passes by him and she goes, ow. And it turns out that Amir is her superior resident, like many, many levels above her. Wow. And she yells at him. She says, ow, watch where you're going. And then, you know, 20 minutes later, she's being introduced to him as her senior resident. And she all of a sudden is looking down at her papers, very ashamed that she just chastised her senior resident and that he's damn good looking.
that is the making of a movie. If I can say that, that's the making of a movie. I'm telling you, I just want to be a supporting character when the movie comes out.
Listen, well, you and we're gonna get your leading man to come on, you know, in the background. So, you know, that he won't say no to.
He better.
If I give him a walk on role, no.
So people are to buy this book. Why should people buy your book? Why should people want to get encased in this type of thing?
Absolutely.
Is it because they, you know, when people buy books like these, it's because they live vicariously through the characters. Is it because they relate to the characters? Why should persons want to buy your book?
Well, I would say that that is one reason to relate to the characters, but there are many, many layers to this book. Mm-hmm. So beginning with, what I just mentioned, which was the difficult childhood and how a lot of teens and young adults can relate to, not saying that early teens should read this book because, you know, some of the language and the sex scenes are for mature audiences. But, you know, young adults can very much relate to what it's like to grow up awkward and to have a difficult childhood, have a difficult time relating with other kids. So you've got that underlying the whole thing. And that's also fueling this tremendous drive in this child to become successful. And it's causing a lot of stress in her life. So that stress is another layer. The stress that a lot of people can relate to because maybe their parents put that stress on them or, that stress is coming from some other source, whether they grew up very poor and they want to have some money, wherever that stress is coming from. The next point, though, is Amir and Rory are an interracial couple and an interreligious couple. Okay, so he is Pakistani and she is Jewish. I chose that for a reason. I didn't choose a white-black couple or a white Indian couple or a white Asian couple. I chose a Jewish and a Muslim couple because I still feel that's a frontier that we have not conquered, not even close. I think that there's so much tension in the Middle East, for instance, between those groups. And that tension has seeped around the world. So these are two religions that do not mix. And even if you look into the background, which I spend some chapters actually with Rory discovering his traditions and vice versa, where she's, you know, going back and forth, making some very big decisions. They have a lot in common. Some their religions are actually, they have a lot of things in common. Believe it or not, they go, you know, the early Muslim education is called midrash, whereas the Jewish religion is yeshiva, but midrasha means in Hebrew, it's educational school. So they're taught to dress modestly. They're taught that there are differences between women and men. There's just a lot that there is in common, but there are two religions that are really at war with one another. And I mean that literally. I don't just mean that figuratively. So I wanted to, go into that West Side Story motif, that Romeo and Juliet motif, and talk about how these two star-crossed lovers can try to defy the odds. And I'm not going to give away whether they do or don't during this chat that we're having. Even though I've said love conquers all, I'm not going to give away whether they are able to conquer all the pressures against them. The other thing is that Rory is going to medical school in her state school. So she's in her hometown. Her parents find out about this relationship very quickly, and they get very involved in whether or not she's allowed to be dating a boy like this. So the early controlling doesn't stop as she turns into a young adult. So the other thing is that, that's another motif. And then another thing that I've done a lot of in this book is I've actually brought the reader into the hospital. And I don't just mean walking down the hallways. I take them into surgeries. I walk them through the entire procedures. And I make them feel as if they're doing the procedure themselves.
So vicarious to vicarious, you're in there.
And I also try to make, as they're weaving through the carotid artery or whatever vessel they're, it's sensual. So the surgeries are sensual.
Heard surgery sexy yet. I've never heard of sexy surgery.
It is. I'm not currently practicing as I pursue my biotech, but when I was operating, it's a sensual art in many ways. I mean, you have to be artistic about it. To draw the perfect lines and find the perfect planes in the body. So I wanted that to be sensual. And then finally, even the sex scenes, even the sex scenes, I wanted to be an educator on every level. So I actually brought in what happens in the human body physiologically, anatomically, during those scenes. So I actually do a little bit of teaching about what happens during those scenes.
I saw some reviews here. It's a page turner. Couldn't put it down. I wonder why. I wonder why.
So, I mean, my whole sort of shtick in life is that I like teaching people, and I like imparting whatever wisdom that has been imparted to me and passing it forward. So this book actually has a lot of wisdom in it. It's not just a feel-good book. It is very entertaining, and I do think it is a page-turner that you can't put down. But in addition, I wanted to mention those layers.
What's coming up for Dr. L.B. Wells?
White Coat Effect 2, the Rise of the Boy.
I am not going to go any further because I haven't read this first book yet. So you are already on to the next one.
Oh, we're writing the second one. And there will be a younger male character that possibly diverts her attention. And there'll be three characters now that add to the complexity.
That sounds like life, everyday life to me. Things come in, distracts you, take you off your course. You find yourself, learn about yourself.
It's more complicated than that. I don't want to give this away, but there is something in medicine called the match. And it's a little bit like sorority rush. You put down the top, say, 20 choices that you have of hospitals where you want to go to, and they put down their top 20 to 30 students that they want to match at their facility. And a big computer in the sky does the math, and they find the tightest fit. And the top, say, five people that fit the top 5 fit at both mm-hmm. places, both your choices and their choices, becomes the class. So it's not like interviewing for a regular job where you're, you know, mm-hmm. showing up. I mean, you do have to interview, obviously, but you don't, you know, show up and say, hey, you know, do I have the job? It's a match, and it's a it's binding a contract. So wherever it is that you match, that's where you go. So I'm not saying whether she stays in her hometown or not, but the match, you know, may or may not separate these two lovers.
You know, and as we're rounding up the conversation and you say a match, I'm a spiritual person and I believe that there is a match for everyone out there. And just like you said,
that's
a big computer
definition of a match, but I love that definition.
Yes, yes, there is a match for us, and there's a person in the sky, just like you said, there's a big computer in the sky.
I know a doctor somewhere near you that seems to be a match for you.
Are you serious? Let's talk offline, girl. Let's talk offline. But coming to my point, as we round up, there is a match for everyone, you know, and there is, if you want to call him a computer in the sky, that is matching someone for you. You know?
Yeah. Oh, by the way, I am drawing a distinction between a god and the match that matches that is the computer in the sky.
Of course.
They're not one in the same. They're not actually a computer.
Of course, I know. But I'm putting it to this whole matching thing, you know, that there is someone.
It's a very, very nice metaphor.
Yeah, there is. So you see, I have been featuring your book and I have it positioned right there on the screen so people know where to find you. We scroll through the reviews and everything. So if you want to get your book, they know how to get it. And so I want to just say, this has been a great job from what you have been on my show. Was it a year or two ago? I can't even remember. I think it was
about a
year ago. Yeah. And time flies. And here you are, you're writing, you're coming up with another book. I mean, you're on a roll and you're still beautiful as ever. You haven't changed. People, let me tell you, this girl, she hasn't changed. And you would think as a surgeon, board certified, I could tell you so much about her, but I'm not. You know, she just is so, I mean, when you think of a doctor, you think, oh, stumpy and stuffy and, oh, she's not. I would be like, I'm like, are you sure?
Well, how could I be and then write a book like this?
Right? So this is bringing out another side of you, which is great. And that's the thing about human beings. We are complex.
Well, and that's actually why I chose the pseudonym also. It's not for fear of, you know, divulging who I am. And I suspect that at some point I will. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, writing under a pseudonym made it easier to have an alter ego.
Oh, yes.
You know, to made it easier to have that, you know, that second side of myself that I could just kind of go crazy with.
And that's a beautiful thing about it.
I went a little crazy and I think everybody will enjoy that.
I don't think you went crazy. You went where you needed to go. Dr. L.B. Wells, it's been a pleasure again having you as a repeat offender.
I saw where you put that thing, but also if you go through Amazon and click in the White Coat Effect or L.B. Wells, it should come up as well if you don't want to go through my website.
Not a problem at all. It's been a pleasure talking with you again. As I said, I will use your terms. I repeat offender on my show, Between the Lines. It's great having you. I look forward to having you again when you bring out number 2 of the White Coat Effect.
As always, Corinne, it's such a pleasure. Wonderful to see you. You have been an excellent professional and lovely host.
Thank you so much. All the best to you.
And beautiful, really. The doctor would be mad.
And don't forget, you need to match me. You're a matchmaker.
I'm trying here. I'm trying.
All the best.
I told you I'll give him a walk and roll on the movie if we get a movie. I'll do anything, you know. I'll give a principal role, you know.
Oh yeah. Thank you so much, my dear. All the best to you.
You're welcome.